Yeah, the only thing that I would see there as having a bit of an impact is he's moving to a better lineup. He's moving to a better team. Gianella, and welcome to episode 170 of Flags Fly Forever, a fantasy baseball prospectus podcast. With me tonight is a new voice, or a voice we've had on before, but it's been a long time since he's been on. Actually, this is only the second time he's been on, and we're mixing up the format a little bit and changing some of the personnel. So I want to reintroduce our fantasy editor, and also participant in Labor NL and Tout Wars Mixed, Zach Steinhorn. Zach, how are you doing on this fine Thursday evening as we're recording?
I am doing well. My fantasy rotation not doing so well, with Carlos Martinez already being horrible this in the second half. But other than that, I'm pretty good.
Yeah, I have a couple of shares of Kyle Hendricks, so even though it could have been much worse, I feel your pain. And another change we have, and I'm very pleased about this, behind the glass we have Jen Mac Ramos, who she's here in a producing capacity, but she's really great. You can find her work, among other places, at the Hardball Times, and it's just really great to have her, you know, as part of our podcast, and having her production skills and acumen. So it is, as I mentioned before, it's Thursday. It's July 19th. This will reach your ears in all likelihood tomorrow or the next day. And we're going to be talking trades. It's that time of year, as you know. And as we're recording this, there have been a couple of pretty big trades in Major League Baseball. There'll be a few more in the week or two ahead, and we're going to kick right off with the big one. We're going to kick off with Manny Machado heading from the Baltimore Orioles to the Los Angeles Dodgers. He was swapped, as you know, nearly every trade is these days, for prospects. We're not going to talk that much about the prospects, if at all. We leave that to our brother podcast in Tino. But we are going to talk about the impact of Machado a little bit for fantasy. So, Zach, let's start off with kind of the obvious piece here with Machado. So he's moving from the American League to the National League. Obviously, in any league that's not in only, there's no impact to this. You know, it's Manny Machado. He's going to be in your lineup. He's been an elite or near elite player this year. But how do you see the ballpark, the lineup, everything else like that impacting him, if at all?
I really don't think it's going to change much. I mean, I think he moves into a better lineup. The Orioles have been vastly underachieving as an offense this season. So he does move into a better lineup. The ballpark, I guess, isn't as favorable for hitters. But Machado is the kind of hitter that, you know, he's so consistent and good that I don't really think that the team he plays for or the home ballpark he plays in really has much of an impact on his production.
Yeah, the only thing that I would see there as having a bit of an impact is he's moving to a better lineup. He's moving to a better team. The run opportunities, the RBI opportunities should increase. I mean, that could be offset slightly because it's the National League and the pitchers at the bottom of the lineup. But really, I agree with you. You're mostly talking about a change there where you're like, okay, well, it might boost his value slightly, but if you're in a tight race, or I should say, unless you're in a really tight race, it's not going to push you over the top or hurt you if the team that has Machado is chasing your team. So let's move over. You know, this is kind of the more interesting fantasy conversation. What happens with the Orioles, Zach? So they're already a really bad team, and I don't want to say historically bad. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're off to an awful, they're having an awful season. What happens to their lineup? Who slides in for Machado? Who's the beneficiary there? And what do you do, honestly, if you have an Orioles hitter at this point? Because really, even in a deep mixed league, there aren't a lot of guys on that team that I'm looking at thinking that I have to have or essentials to my lineup.
Yeah, and I guess, well, Tim Beckham is the obvious choice to slide in at shortstop, but he's been having a terrible season, so as is pretty much the entire rest of the lineup. So he'll move over to shortstop. He's still not much of a fantasy impact player, from a mixed league perspective. And like you were mentioning with the trades, you know, guys like Jonathan Schoop might get traded and other players on the offense might get traded. So a lot can change even between now and July 31st. But I don't think there's really anyone other than maybe Schoop in the Orioles lineup right now that you feel good about from a mixed league standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just even glancing at this from a real life perspective. You know, if you look at the warp and the positive contributions players have made, after Machado, you've got three players who are slightly above replacement level, and Greg Gentry, or I should say hitters, Mark Trumbo and Chan Sisko. And that's real life. So that doesn't even take into account, you know, it takes into account defense a little bit for Gentry and Sisko. It's just a terrible situation for fantasy. And there's something to me in mono leagues. So, you know, Zach, you took over NL Labor this year. Our listeners know I jumped into that auction because sadly one of the longtime participants, Steve Moyer, passed away the weekend of the auction, and they tabbed me to fill in. So Zach's been managing that team. You know, Zach, it's you know, NL only 12 teams, out of an NL universe. I know you were surprised at how deep that league was, because week in, week out, there are practically no, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are practically no hitting replacements to be had.
Right. I had to actually bid $23 on Joey Lucchesi in the beginning of the season just to get a formidable rotation put together. So in the beginning of the year, I was really surprised by how thin the waiver wire pool was. But now I'm kind of getting used to it. Unfortunately, we'll actually talk about Brad Hand in a little bit, but that connects to our NL Labor team. But I'm gradually getting more comfortable with it. But hopefully I don't have the most fab of anyone in the league, so I'm not going to be able to get Machado. So I'm hoping that after the 31st trade deadline, I'll at least be able to get someone who's an impact player for the lineup.
Yeah, and that's a broader question I think we'll address on the next show. But really, you know, if you have Machado, I'd say, you know, that's the one no-brainer. If you're in an NL only, you're obviously throwing all of your fab at Manny Machado. There's nobody, like, who do you think might be the second best player to possibly get traded into the National League if you had to guess?
I can't even begin to think of it.
I put you on the spot. Sorry about that.
I have to go through all the teams on my list.
I should make you do like the 5-second thing where I make you blurt it out.
I don't know. Maybe Clint Frazier. That's a possibility, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, the name that popped into my head was Mike Moustakas, but somebody, it might've been Mike Petrillo over at MLB. He pointed out that, you know, you look at Moustakas, you look at the Phillies and Braves who have been linked to a third baseman, and he and Franco and he and Johan Camargo, they're about the same. Like, they're at least, you know, when you look at the advanced statistics for offense, they're kind of similar. You know, the Phillies in particular, I know them better than the Braves because I live in this market. They're analytically minded enough that I don't see them bringing in Moustakas simply for leadership and doing that. And besides, they already have leaders and players like Jake Arrieta and Carlos Santana. So yeah, Machado is a no brainer. He's somebody who I'd want to be using all my fab on. So I don't think there's really an imperative. So for Beckham, you're saying in a deeper mixed league, even if he's out there, you'd either hold off, or if you absolutely had a need, like, it would just be a minimal bid.
Yeah, he's just a need-based acquisition. It's not someone that I'm overly excited about going into the rest of the season. Though he did have a nice year last year. I think he hit over 20 homers. So this season, actually, he's been a little surprisingly bad, but We have to go by the recent results, and there's just not a lot to get excited about.
Yeah, and the other side of that, and we'll move on to the hand trade after this. The other side of that really is it was a nice season when you break it down. I think it was like a nice 6 weeks or 2 months. He didn't. It wasn't like he was consistent all the way through. He kind of had a hot streak, and then just disappeared. So as I mentioned, we're gonna move on to the other big trade that just happened today, and you know I was kind of surprised by it because I think we all thought he'd get traded. It was just a matter of the timing of the trade. I thought it would happen closer to the deadline. So Brad Hand was moved from the San Diego Padres to Cleveland. And, you know, so the first question right off the bat, this is the biggest question. So how do you see the saves playing out in Cleveland, Zach? Do you see Brad Hand closing? Do you see Cody Allen closing? Do you see a committee with the two of them? And when Andrew Miller returns, if you had to place your educated guess right now, who's the leader in saves from now until the end of the season for Cleveland?
I think it's still Cody Allen. I think maybe Brad Hand gets 3 or 4 saves from here on out, but I think Cody Allen is still the guy. He hasn't done anything to lose the job. So I think barring an injury, I don't think Hand, outside of maybe in deeper mixed leagues, you want to hold on to him just for the help in the ratios and the few saves he might get from here on out. But I think Hand, it's not, kind of similar to the situation in Washington with Doolittle and Herrera, that I think it's they have a guy who can close, but I don't think that he's going to get a meaningful number of saves for the rest of the season.
Yeah, the one thing about that could be interesting is I could see them playing matchups. You know, Allen's right-handed, Hand is left-handed. We've kind of seen that more and more now. Neither one of those pitchers is strictly, you know, I don't infer that one of them is strictly, you know, lefty-lefty or righty-righty, but I could see that kind of scenario playing out. You know, you are right about, you know, the funny thing about Allen is that he's not having the year that he's not having nearly the year that he's had in the past. You know, I look at his ERA, I look at his peripherals. He's certainly been okay. And I know the deal with relievers too. Often the ERA can be clouded or thrown into disarray by one bad outing, but he has a 4.66 ERA. So I think you're right. I think Allen is still the guy. He's the play for me, and I wouldn't throw all of my money on Brad Hand for Fab unless this, you know, this weekend he gets like 2 saves, and Allen doesn't get any, and it's not that situation I mentioned where it's lefty lefty, but it's something I'd watch. I for me, in a deeper mix, if I can stash Hand and can, or even use him as a back end, like last guy and stream him and reserve him and activate him, I would do that. I would say, you know, 10 team mix, 12 team mix, he's somebody who, if I have the space, great. But if you're talking about one of those ESPN leagues where it's very limited reserves, I do agree with you. He's not somebody you're necessarily going to want to waste that roster spot on, you know, just because of the different rules and configurations there.
Right. In a 15 team mix, I would definitely hold on to him. And he's borderline in a 12 team mix, but if you do have the roster space, but I wouldn't, in those shallower leagues, I wouldn't hold off on grabbing someone who could help you now, you know, just to stash Hand. But yeah, I was actually surprised to hear about Allen's ERA is actually higher than I thought it was. And it's funny because he really hasn't blown a lot of saves, but I guess he's given up, you know, runs in a lot of outings with multiple run leads. So, but one thing with Allen too is last year we thought he was going to lose the job to Andrew Miller. So he's a guy that's kind of always been like on the verge of losing the job, but he never does. He always pitches well enough to keep it. So it seems like he's, you know, still hanging on to it even the following year.
Yeah, I think the only difference again this year is last year that perception existed because Miller in 2016 had been ridiculous. Like he was so good and so amazing. And there was that back and forth of like, okay, well, why would you take this? You know, the argument for Allen was, why would you take this great asset in Miller out of the, you know, out of the equation as seventh, eighth inning guy? Allen's better as a one inning resource. This year, the argument would be because Hand is having a subpar year. Now, the one thing I should point out, you know, since this is baseball prospectus, I'm saying he's having a subpar year. Our metric, and this is what's important, our metric, our DRA, supports him pretty much having the same year that he had last year. He has a 2.60 DRA as we're talking right now, and that's slightly like fraction, you know, or 0.01 better than what he did last year. So from Baseball Prospectus's standpoint, he's having pretty much the same year. His CFIP is a little bit higher, but not so much that I'd worry about him. The one thing with Allen that changed a little bit is his ground ball rate in 2016 was almost 50%. It's 34 in 2017, 33% this year. That's kind of the thing with Allen. He's a little more homer prone as a result, but even that hasn't jumped up much. So he should be fine. It is a tough thing with closers that we know, which is all it takes is a bad week. And if you've got an asset like Brad Hand, you know, sitting back there in reserve, they could switch. But I do agree with your general premise, Zach. I would say that Allen is likely to get most of the saves, assuming he doesn't just completely implode.
Yeah, he's not in that elite tier of closers, but I think he's sort of in that acceptable number one closer towards the back end of that top 10 or 12. And I don't really think anything has changed, even though his numbers might not be as great this season. But I still value him as a borderline number one closer in a mixed league.
Yeah, that's fair. So let's move to San Diego and their, well, a couple things. So first of all, we'll have to talk about their bullpen. So the closer right now, unless he's traded, is Kirby Yates. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. But now there's word that he might be traded pretty soon. So that'll make things even more interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, I have Yates in a couple leagues. I forget, Zach, are you? I think the answer is no. Are you in that great fantasy baseball invitational that Justin Mason put together?
I am, but not in your league. In one of the 13 leagues.
Oh, you are in one of them. Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's I completely lose track of who's in it, who isn't.
I'm in league 12.
I'm in five. And I think Justin deliberately didn't put or tried to avoid putting people together, like who were from the same website or affiliation, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, actually, I'm John Heglin is in my league. So that's the only guy that works from the same site as me that's in my league.
Yeah, see, I don't have any of those. Yeah, so I'm looking at Yates, and this is something about fantasy baseball. So I really, one of the things I enjoy about it and like is it really has made me appreciate real baseball, which sounds kind of funny because if you play Roto like we do, it would seem the opposite because you're, you know, ignoring, you know, hits like triples and doubles are worth the same as singles, and, you know, saves are a bad statistic and we overemphasize it. You know, same is true of stolen bases. But if you play in deep leagues like Zach and I do, you kind of start to appreciate a guy like Kirby Yates. Kirby Yates, his numbers this year are eye-popping. He's got a 1.43 ERA. It's supported by a 1.93 DRA. His, you know, the TAV against is also minuscule. Like, everything that he's doing this year is just ridiculous. And the funny thing about that is, you know, I talked about ground ball rate with Allen. Yates' strikeout rate has actually dropped quite a bit. You know, he's doing it by inducing grounders, by getting the worm burner. So no one's getting any elevation off of him. He's just keeping the ball on the ground and in the park. And, you know, Petco certainly, you know, after 2017, where the balls are flying out a little bit more, has gone back to being more of a pitching environment. But that's definitely the change for Yates. Yates has altered his approach. He's become a ground ball pitcher. And regardless of where he goes or lands, you know, I would say, disagree with me if you want to, Zach, but if he does stay in San Diego, I would say he'd be fine as a closer, no?
Oh, definitely. There's really nothing that he's done this year that would make you doubt that. I mean, you see this a lot with relievers every year. It's just hard to predict which reliever's going to break out. And this year, you know, Kirby Yates, who would have thought Kirby Yates in 2018 would be one of those guys. So if he is indeed the closer the rest of the season, he's, I think, a rock solid closer. But if he's not, then you're going to have to play the waiver wire saves game once again.
Yeah, so I guess the question with Yates would be, so if you have Fab to burn, and, you know, whether you had Hand or not, what's your play on Yates? Like, let's start with NL only. Do you bid? You have to bid something on him if he's available, though he's probably gone in nearly every NL only. But assuming he's out there for some reason, what do you bid?
I'd say, well, depending on how much money I have left, I would feel comfortable bidding maybe 10% of my remaining money on him, depending on what I have. But I would be comfortable making a pretty aggressive bid for him. Of course, depending on your need and the places you are and saves and the standings and things like that. But I'm optimistic about him.
Okay, so let's move to mixed. Is he? I don't know if you know off the top of your head, and I know you're both in both. You're in tout. So is he available in tout? Do you know off the top of your head or no?
He is owned. Okay. He was picked up a while ago, maybe a month ago, and he's been held on to. And in our league, historically, in our league, people, owners grab all these closers, and there's really no one left. And you think someone's going to be available, you go to the waiver wire, and you see that he's already owned. So Yates was picked up a while ago for I think he's picked up for maybe a dollar. And so now,
you're not like me. You don't sit there and obsessively like stare at your free agent pools.
I do. Okay. But sometimes I think that someone is available who isn't, and that was the case with Yates. But it's funny how owners in these leagues, like, they grab a speculative reliever for a dollar, and then their timing is perfect, and then a week later that reliever's price would go up to $100. So it's just sometimes it's just all about luck, or partially about luck more than anything else. But yeah, Yates is owned, and I think Stammen is available, so maybe I'll go after him next week.
You jump to my next question. So he's your guy, like, assuming that if either you think Yates is going to be traded or he does get traded, is that your play in the San Diego bullpen?
I think so. I'll have to do a little more research on the numbers and see if there's anyone else legitimate that's an option. But I think he's the guy. But then again, they could do that whole closer by committee thing, and that could ruin everything. But we'll find out.
Yeah. Yeah, before we move off of this and go on to Francisco Mejia, I wanted to bring that up as well. So you made a great point earlier about closers, and that's something that has changed so much. I made this point last year in the American League that it used to be 30 saves. Even if there was a change in role, you'd see enough guys get 30 saves. You'd be like, okay, well, a third of the closers to half in any given year aren't going to get to that number. And usually it's because of ineffectiveness or because of a role change. But what you'd see is, one guy would get moved out of the role, another guy would get moved in. That's it. I mean, what you're seeing now, the Phillies are an extreme example of this, but what you're seeing now is you're seeing teams really going for the outs as opposed to going for the saves. Sir Anthony Dominguez is the best reliever in the Phillies bullpen, and I don't think it's particularly close. Victor Arano has been solid. Dominguez is the guy from a skills perspective that you want. But if you have him, and I have him in a couple leagues, including tout, I snagged him early there, you're not getting a high volume of saves from Sir Anthony Dominguez.
Yeah, and I think you see it also in Milwaukee with Josh Hader. And, as good as he is, he has, what, eight, nine saves on the season? So teams are definitely content to just mix and match. And like you said, it's not about ineffectiveness. It's about just playing the matchups. So that actually makes those Kenley Jansens even more valuable now, because you're going to get 40 saves from him. So that's an interesting little angle to the whole closer strategy thing on draft day.
I've always said this about closers, and it's more true now. If I'm going to spend big money or a high draft slot on a closer, in drafts in particular, I want to avoid it for a number of reasons. But in an auction, if I'm going to spend over 20 on a 260 budget on a closer, I want it to be on a guy like Jansen or even Wade Davis. And I think you groaned a little bit at Davis when you saw he was on the labor team I'd purchased and you're managing. I want the guy with the big contract, because a team is incented to try as much as possible to stick with that closer. Although we know, Mark Melanson is an example, but we know that if the closer is bad enough, that contract isn't necessarily going to save the job.
Right. And you actually saw that. And that's why that Brad Hand trade was surprising to me, because that was it was a reasonable contract, but it was for, 4 years. So that kind of surprised me.
Well, so that's a good segue. So one of the reasons I believe the Padres made that trade is because of what they got. So the return on that trade, the Machado trade, was more volume. And I'm not saying that to disparage any of the prospects in that deal. You know, prospecting isn't a science. All these players are very good, if not excellent, baseball players. You know, to even get to double or triple A, you have to be at a level that, you know, is difficult to imagine. But in terms of being a top flight prospect or elite prospect, there really wasn't one in that trade. The Padres got a prospect who is elite and who potentially can make an impact even this year in Francisco Mejia. So, Zach, what's your take on the Padres, you know, and behind the plate? You know, what do you think is going to happen there? How do you think that's going to play out this year? And I guess in particular, you know, beyond this year.
Well, Mejia, widely considered as the top catching prospect in baseball. So the Padres, it'll be interesting to see if the Indians, I think, were flirting with the idea of moving him to the outfield or just using him as DH. But the Padres obviously can use him as DH. But it will be, let's see if they keep him at catcher. They do have Austin Hedges, who has been disappointing offensively, but he's still considered to be an above average defender. So they have Hedges for a catcher possibility, or they could put Mejia at catcher and move maybe trade Hedges, or just put Mejia in the outfield and keep Hedges there. So I think they're probably going to give Mejia a chance to be a catcher, because I think that's where his bat value lies. But we'll have to see. They just certainly got a nice return for Han, that's for sure.
Yeah, I guess what I'm wondering more than anything else is, I would have to think that Mejia is going to be up at some point in 2018. The question is, will he be up next month, or will it just be that cup of coffee in September?
I think it could be next month. I mean, he's hitting, let's see, in the minor leagues this year, .279 average with 7 homers and 45 RBIs in 79 games. So it's not elite offensive numbers, but it's still promising. So I think the Padres are smart. I think they will want to see what they have in him for a more extended period of time than just, say, 15, 20 games at the end of the season.
Yeah, it really does come down a lot to, you know, as you pointed out, Hedges' framing metrics or BP's framing metrics on Hedges are positive. They were much more positive last year, but the scouting backs that up, that he's an impact there. You know, the bat is kind of rough. Like that's what it comes down to with Hedges. And I know a number of teams are relying more and more. You know, they have their own internal framing metrics. They're relying a lot more on that than obviously Baseball Prospectus metrics. I know from talking to Harry Pavlidis that, you know, they're certainly not two completely different elements. There's some similarities, but regardless of which metrics you're looking at or whether it's scouting, Hedges is an asset behind the plate. It's just going to be a question of how the Padres figure that out. My guess for 2019 and beyond is that they'll try to trade Hedges and move on from him and try to get something and try to keep Mejia behind the plate. Because to your point, Zach, moving him to the outfield, you lose some of that value at the bat. Then you go from having an above average bat behind the plate, or maybe even a special bat if everything works out, to a very good bat, you know, and maybe a little bit better than that in the outfield.
Right. As long as Mejia is adequate behind the plate, I think they're going to keep him at catcher and try to trade Hedges. Hedges has power, but his average is just terrible. So I could totally see them just moving on from Hedges and putting Mejia there.
Well, the thing with that too, you know, I remember this conversation a couple years ago with Wilson Contreras. So when Wilson Contreras came up, there was a knock on him, and we've seen some of this with Mejia too. There was a knock on Contreras about his defense and it being raw and him needing work, particularly with handling pitchers. Wilson Contreras, you don't hear that anymore. And part of the reason you don't hear it anymore is, you know, I know, well, you know, his framing metrics at BP are poor. But in terms of the rest of Contreras' game, and particularly with working with pitchers, he's seen as having really worked on that, really improved. And that's what it comes down to, is if San Diego can do the same thing with Mejia, they're going to do it. And I just don't think they acquired him to have him platoon with Austin Hedges.
Right, and that's an important point too. You know, players' skills aren't exactly static. If you have a great coaching staff that could improve your defensive ability, that's a key, you know, factor to consider. Mejia may be a below average defender right now, but he could certainly improve, and that would be ideal for San Diego. They could just keep him behind the plate.
Okay, so I think that's it on the major league trading topics. We did want to talk a little bit and jump into something else tonight. So we're going to shift gears. And Zach, I think I'm going to have you kick this topic off to start with, since you had brought this up in the pre-show when we talked this through. So why don't I let you do that?
Was this about the dumb trades? So dumb trades, this is actually a topic that Mike wrote about in an article last week. The issue of owners in keeper leagues, non-contending owners, just dumping high-end players for either attractive keepers or draft picks or things like that, and the issue of maybe questions about fairness of the trade or other owners being complaining about it. So, what are ways to address this issue that's fair and that won't really disrupt the integrity of the league? I commission a longstanding home league that uses round values instead of auction values. So you don't have that in-season cap as a solution. You have to find something else. And so far we've been every August, every July, every August, we have the same issue where people get, you know, upset that the first place team, you know, gave up, with Tim Anderson to get JD Martinez and, you know, trades like that. But I wish there was an easy way to address it, but it's a challenge.
Yeah, I don't know what the solution is in that kind of format, because as you pointed out, auction formats are good that way. You can set a cap. There's other mechanisms you can use. You know, the mechanism I mentioned in the article about pushing players' salaries up is effective from that standpoint of, well, you know, you still get the player for next year. You know, I'm trying to have a good example. So if you have, you know, Moncada and he's at $3, I use Ozzy Albies in the article, so I'll use him. So if you have Ozzy Albies for some reason at $3 and he gets bumped up to 15, well, you still have got a really good keep at Ozzy Albies, but now you don't nearly have as much value. So you're still going to trade for him. I think the concern for me, it isn't just how it helps the teams for this year. It's the cyclical nature of it. If you have a team that trades for four or five players like Albies and they're all super cheap, you wind up with a situation nearly every year where you have three or four super teams and then you have a bunch of teams in the middle or the bottom that aren't very good. Now, the one thing I'll point out, that the league you're in, Zach, is it dynasty or is it just keeper?
It's a dynasty league, but you just keep up to five players. But you can keep,
okay. Well, so
it's kind of a modified dynasty league. You keep up to five players for as long as 3 years, and then they get released back to the player pool.
See,
and every year you keep them, their round value gets divided by two. So
isn't this exciting, folks? It's it's 11:12 at night here on the East Coast, and this is
exciting to me.
I know it's exciting for us, and I'm sure it's exciting for the people listening to us. But to me, that's, and this is getting more exciting as I delve into this point. So to me, that's more of a keeper. I always think of dynasty as a true dynasty as keep forever, but also, and I'm splitting hairs here, like being able to keep a significant number of players. So it sounds like you do have some sort of mechanism in place where it's like, yes, you can trade, you can make those trades, but you can't collect like 10 or 12 or 15 players,
right,
that are all young and up and comers and then just sit there with those players indefinitely.
Right. You have a limit of five keepers, and a lot of times at least a couple of those keepers are going to be those high end players and maybe you keep for a fifth rounder or a sixth rounder. So you generally have to kind of assemble a group of maybe two really low round, late round keepers to be in good shape, but you still have that issue of like what's the equivalent of JD Martinez as a keeper? You know, what's fair in that way? And also for those non-contending teams, like, did they do enough work to get the best deal possible, or did they just settle for the first offer they got? So
that leads me to a comment and a question. I'll start with the question because I don't want to go veer too far off of this. What do you think? I played in a league like this once. What do you think of the idea of providing notice, like of having a mechanism where it's like, okay, I'm announcing to the league, or I have to announce to the league that I'm giving up, and then there has to be a period of time, whether it's like 48 or 72 hours, where you're like, all right, that person can't make a trade until that time period passes. Do you think that's something that would work?
That could work, but I also think that in my league, at least, people tend to do that. It's rare that someone's just going to not announce to anyone that they're selling, but still, you know, sometimes it happens, but it doesn't happen that often in my league. But yeah, the suggestion you have would definitely improve it, but I wish there was still a better, more, you know, forceful answer to it.
Yeah, and you know, my problem with that suggestion, that league that I played in, what would often happen is the deal would be worked out anyway, and you kind of knew it. And so the 48 or 72 hours was almost a game where you're like, okay, so I'm going to have to wait two or three days for this trade to go through that I know is going to go through between these two friends who always or almost always make a trade.
Yeah, I made a trade. I'm a contender this year, and I traded like draft picks for Chris Sale, and then people just like went crazy. And I'm like, well, you know what? A fourth round draft pick is pretty valuable. You know, it's more valuable than Tim Anderson. So
right. So can you only and that's a challenge with draft leagues. So the auction, are you, besides Labor and Tout, are you in any auction leagues, or is that it?
I used to be in one. That's it right now. Yeah.
Okay. So I mostly do auction leagues, and we can't trade auction money for the next season. Like, you can't trade it away. You can't acquire it. The only future considerations we can trade in the one kind of old school home league I'm left in are future draft picks. Well, and you can trade minor leaguers too, but we only have two of those picks year in, year out. So it's not like we have like this, you know, 10 or 12 round minor league draft where, you know, where you're in the 10th round and you really need those dynasty lists that Brett and Ben and, you know, put together.
Right. Yeah, we're allowed to trade draft picks, but we can only trade two draft picks per season. So I kind of capped it at that just to make it
okay.
But there's still that, you know, equivalent draft pick equivalency that people have a hard time thinking.
Well, I think, you know, what a lot of this conversation comes down to is setting a market. And what makes this challenging, and I point this out in the piece as well. So we just had a trade in the league I'm in, and it's an AL only. And the team playing for next year got Jose Ramirez at 15. And he gets to keep him for two more years at that price. So that's obviously great. You know, everyone else he got, it was a 4 for 4. Like, everyone else he got in the deal, he got Clint Frazier at 10, which is a risk, because if Clint Frazier gets traded next week to a National League team, this guy gets nothing.
Right.
And then he got like two, you know, filler players. And he gave away, and the salaries aren't important, because, and you know, the best player in this deal is a free agent in our league next year. He got Mookie Betts, who, as I just said, is going to be available in auction no matter what next year. He got Edwin Encarnacion, Didi Gregorius, and Ryan Healy. So I know some people who would look at that return and go, wow, he essentially got four players, four everyday hitters for one, you know, everyday hitter in Jose Ramirez, who's certainly great. But then, you know, someone who might or might not play and might even leave in Clint Frazier, and two players, I didn't mention their names, but two players who honestly are kind of bottom of the barrel guys. I know one was Victor Martinez. Oh, and Charlie Tilson, who just got sent down. So you might react to that trade, Zach. You might be thinking, oh my gosh, that's a lot. And even compared to what I was talking about in my league, that's a lot. But truthfully, that's how the market has been set in my league. Like, that's just the way those trades go down. Like, I've got Aaron Judge cheap in that league at 10. and I have to give him a contract next year, and I'll probably bump him up to 20 and keep him for three more years. But I'm not trading Aaron Judge. Like, if the guy who had Mike Trout offered him to me for Judge straight up, I'm not doing that because of the contract difference.
Right. And that was the answer to the guy who traded with me, traded Sale to me. He responded to the questions by saying, you know what, it's all about the market. And the best I could, getting a fourth round pick for Chris Sale is, you know, pretty good. So you have to, and you know, yeah. it gets tough as a commissioner too, because it's like, I don't veto any trades unless it's obviously one-sided or I think there's collusion involved. So, you know, it gets to this situation where it's like, you know, there's a point where you want your league to be fun and you want people to be upset, but at the same time, you know, you want there to be fair rules and you want people to be able to, you know, make those types of trades to win now.
Yeah, and we don't even have a veto mechanism in my league. And part of it is it's been around forever. It's very stable. I believe we've had two changes in members in the last 10 years. And that might be a little more than that. But the point being that we all know each other and what works for us works for us. That's kind of the best way to put it. Before we had the salary cap, that wasn't the case. And there was a lot of infighting and a lot of resentment, but I don't think a trade has been overturned in my league in 15 years. Like, it just not something that happens. I agree with you. If something is so egregious and over the top, if you had a trade, like I mentioned, where instead of Jose Ramirez, the player coming back was, you know, Charlie Tilson, and I'm oversimplifying it, you know, at a dollar, that'd be like, all right, well, clearly this is ridiculous. But otherwise, you have to trust judgment. And really, I know others have talked about this too. You have to let people make mistakes. You have to let the bottom feeders in your league make those mistakes. It's their mistake to make.
Right. And we do generally trust everyone. And another thing you could do is, you know, make both parties explain the rationale behind making the trade to make everyone feel, you know, at ease. And it's not like one owner was trying to, you know, trick another owner into making a bad trade. So, you know, you feel better about the trade when both owners explain why they did it and explain why they're happy about it.
So do you do that through message board?
Yeah, we do it through the league message board. We don't, it's not required, but if there is some, you know, some complaining going on, you know, often one of the owners or both of the owners post a message and explain why they did it. And that usually kind of quells some of the arguments and the, you know, dissatisfaction with the trade.
Yeah. I mean, what it all comes down to, and I think we're going to wrap this topic up and the podcast as well. It really does come down to how your league operates, how the market's set, and the comfort level of everybody. And the other piece of this is I've been in leagues where some people just aren't a fit for that league. You know, I play in mostly really deep leagues. We've had people in my AL only, which has been around. I haven't been in it this long, as old as I am. I'm not quite this old. The league I'm in has been around for 30 years. Oh. And yeah, I've been in it for like 20. And it's one of those situations where we had 20 years ago when I joined it, there were four or five people. Some of them, their lives got busier. They had more stuff going on. You know, this is a kind of story I've told before, Zach. One of the people in my league left to go work in Janet Reno's office when she was working for President Clinton, and he wound up the number three at Justice under Barack Obama. So that's a pretty good reason to be too busy for a fantasy league. So I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, that's a good excuse. You're not leaving because you're not leaving because some baloney reason. But in any event, there were also other people who left who, quite honestly, they just weren't good fits for the league. Like, they didn't have the time to put into it. They didn't know the player pool. You know, they didn't know how to research it. They didn't know how to manage a team in a deep league. As much as trading is important, that's important too. And I don't know about you, Zach. I don't know if you have people in that league you're talking about who've cycled in and out, or if it's pretty stable. And if you've had that experience as well, where you've had members in the past where they were in the league for a couple of years or a few years, and were like, you know what, like this just doesn't work for me. I'd rather play in a redraft.
Yeah, I started the league actually. I think I was a senior in high school, and then and since then, which was maybe what was that? Maybe like 16 years ago. And since then, we pretty much cycled through almost everyone. I think there's like two of the 12 people are left from the original group. So in a way, it's kind of, we've evolved and we've made it, you know, we've changed it from a non-keeper to a keeper. We've added the draft pick rules and all that. So it's like you said, it does make it, it does improve the league because you're weeding out the people that either no longer have the time to commit to it, or the people who just, you know, aren't making it as, aren't as serious about it as you'd like them to be at this stage.
Yeah, and I think, as I said, I think we'll wrap it up there. This is a topic that we could talk about for forever and ever, but I think we hit upon all the points that we needed to hit on. Do you have any closing thoughts, Zach, before I throw us to our outro?
No, that's about it. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. What do we have? 11 days away for the trade deadline. So that'll be interesting, especially in Labor NL, to see what players become available on the waiver wire. So
yeah,
that should be cool.
Yeah, I would say that you're absolutely right. With so many teams out of contention in the American League, that's the direction I would expect the talent to flow. I would expect National League teams or NL only teams to be able to use their fab. If you're an AL only, you know, unless Jacob deGrom somehow gets traded and, you know, winds up on an AL team, the pickings could be kind of slim.
Well, I have the fourth most fab, so I'm hoping that at least three other players besides Machado get moved. That's my hope.
Yeah, you know, you reminded me of something, but before we go, I should mention that. So in Tout Wars, I had spent a good chunk of my fab. So I engineered a trade with Tristan Cockcroft of ESPN where I traded him about $125 in fab for Jesse Winker, which means I essentially traded, I got Winker and he's going to get Machado. That was the trade. And the thing behind it for me was that, well, if I didn't do that, I would just have gotten nothing. And I was so far down the pecking order. I think I'm seventh in fab, but I have less than 50% of two of the teams or a number of the teams ahead of me. So theoretically, they could get two players before I even get a shot at a player. So I was like, yeah, even if seven or eight players come in, Winker's going to be better than those players. That was my thinking. And helping Tristan, he's far enough down in the standings where I thought, okay, so I'm helping him, but not help. Hopefully he's far enough back where he's not going to win the league. I'm going to feel like a doofus for helping him.
Right. And that's another thing that you think about late in the season, you know, those placement type of trades where you're just trading with teams that you think could take away points from the guys ahead of you. So
yeah.
That's a good example of that. And that's also a win. It sounds like a win-win trade to me. So that's a perfect trade.
Right. I mean, if I don't make that trade, I don't get Winker. And it's also, you know, Touts an OBP league. Winker, he's not going to have a 40% on base percentage like he's had, but he's been an asset in that category. This is Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus podcast, and we will be right back. Welcome back. This is Mike Gianella at Baseball Prospectus. You've been listening to episode 170 of Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus podcast, along with my co-host, Zach Steinhorn, fantasy editor at Baseball Prospectus, and Jen Mock Ramos behind the glass. Thank you once again for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next week.